Where warp meets weft. Where warp meets weft. This is Weavecast with Sine Mitchell.
Hello, and welcome to episode 37, Color Matters. This episode, we talk with master colorist Kay Fassett and gain insight into how to combine colors in exciting and pleasing ways. Then I share news from the weaving world, talk a bit about the launch of the new WeaveZine site, and in closing, I take you out back to the barn where my sheep are being sheared. February 28th is the birth date of Mary Meigs Atwater. She was born in 1878 and is often referred to as the Dean of Hand Weaving. She's credited with the resurgence of hand weaving that occurred in the U.S. in the 1930s and 50s. Before that, weaving was largely dying off, and it was her shuttlecraft guild monographs that made it possible for people to learn weaving through the mail at a time when there was no easy access to this information. There were no guilds, no traveling teachers, no internet. Her life is documented in the biography, Weaving a Life. It's a compelling read and tells the story of this remarkable woman. And there was a lot more to Mary Meigs Atwater than just the weaving. Bonnie Tarsis, who has been a guest on the show and is a longtime supporter of Weavecast, is offering a special Mary Meigs Atwater horoscope kit to celebrate this amazing weaver's life. And through the month of March, she's donating the proceeds of sales of this kit to help support Weavecast. More information about that is available at Bonnie's blog, Weaving Spirit. And as always, there is a link in the show notes. I got a listener question from Joe. She asked, I wonder if there is a book on weaving letters. And I told her about this tablet weaving book called Please Weave a Message. But she's looking for something specifically for shaft looms. And I didn't know anything about that. But I thought I would ask if you know of a book written for shaft looms that describes how to make fonts, please leave a comment in the show notes because I'd kind of like to have one of those myself. I have a slight correction to my comments about one-to-one coaching. I should have mentioned that this nonprofit organization offers life coaching to women in need at no cost. Isn't that cool? I love it when people do good in the world. A quick movie review. Based on the recommendation of Sally Orgren, I went and saw Coraline. Now, it's not got weaving per se in it, but anyone who loves fiber arts will find a lot to admire in this movie. I will warn you, it's a little bit creepy, but it is nowhere near the gore fest of Wanted. So if you end up going to this movie, you should have a much better time. Doris Florig is working on a project called Weaving the World Together, in which she's going to sew dolls together, encircling a globe. And she's hoping to submit this project as an art piece for Convergence 2010. She's looking for weavers interested in contributing dolls to the project. I will have a link to her website on the show notes. Coming up in weaving events is AnWig 2009, which will be in Spokane in May. I am really excited about going. I love road trips. And I've never been to Spokane. It's right across the mountains from me, but I've never been. They asked me to mention that post-conference only registration is opening up March 12th. So if you're not attending AnWig, but you are interested in those post-conference workshops, March 12th, you can start registering for just those workshops. In other exciting news around here, my husband's latest book is out. My husband is Eric Nyland, a novelist, and his latest book is called Mortal Coils. It was written as a young adult novel, but for some reason the publisher decided to put it in with the science fiction. It's the story of twins Fiona and Elliot who discover one day that their parents are not who they thought they were. I was going to say that this book has nothing to do with weaving, but what's really interesting is that thinking about it, and I don't want to give away one of the major plot points, so I have to be somewhat vague here. Fiber arts is woven all through this text. In fact, it plays rather a large part in the theme of the book, which I find hysterical. Apparently, having all these looms and spinning wheels in the house has seeped into my husband's subconscious and affected this book. So anyway, if you know somebody who really enjoyed Harry Potter, they would probably enjoy this series as well. Today's sponsor is Cotton Clouds. For 30 years, they've specialized in bringing you the finest yarns in cotton and other cellulose fibers like bamboo, rayon chenille, and more. In addition to their yarns, they offer weaving project kits, bamboo color samplers, millen cones, and more. You can check them out online at www.cottonclouds, all one word, .com.
Oh, hello, Stein. This is Barry Schacht in Boulder, Colorado.
I hear you guys have some big news.
We do. Does this relate to our grandson's imminent arrival or our 40th anniversary celebration for being in business at Schacht Spindle Company since 1969?
Well, both sound pretty impressive. Is this your first grandson?
First grandchild.
Ah, well, congratulations.
Yes, we're both not quite sure that we're old enough.
That is just wonderful. But I'd like to talk to you now a little bit about staying in business for 40 years. What's the secret?
In the early years, I think the secret was purely survival. We really weren't quite sure what business was about, but we did need something to do and some income to continue living our relaxed lifestyle, as we say, and did say in those days. But what eventually evolved from just a way to earn a living became a passion and a deep interest. And I think that and connections to people who also are very involved in hand weaving and hand spinning has helped us and steered us in good directions and has allowed us to not only survive 40 years, but continue to thrive in this industry.
One thing people are concerned about right now are hard economic times. And I imagine being in business for 40 years, you've seen both the good times and the bad times. What has helped you get over the bad times?
We've been through probably three recessionary periods. During recession, people tend to draw in. They look for community. They look for something to do that doesn't involve a lot of expenditure. But I think more than anything, they look for some occupation that can be involved with a little bit of learning and community. And we've never, in all of our years, experienced a downturn during recession. Last year was probably the worst recession we've ever seen, and it will continue probably in, you know, many, many months into the next year or two. Last year was our largest growth year ever.
Wow.
I cannot really explain it, but I think we've been here a long time, we're poised, and we have a really good product line. People continue to like us.
Do you think the fact that you're always bringing out new products played into that? Did you have a lot of new products last year?
We did. We had new products, largely responsible for not only getting them out on time, but also for initiating them through an understanding of what the industry is asking for, the consumer part of our industry. It's been my wife, Jane. If I don't produce new products on a regular basis, then I'm woken up at 3 o'clock in the morning and reminded that I have a schedule. So it really is the best thing I can do is to produce new products, not only for my home life, but also for the company itself.
I'm not kicking him in bed. What we're seeing is a few things. Christmas was a pretty good season for us, and then January was very quiet. And I think people were just, they were really worried. And, you know, they were listening to the news, and they were preoccupied, I think, with waiting to see what happened. And now people are accepting that this is how it is, and they're also finding that business isn't so bad for them. People are reporting that they're getting more people signing up for classes than ever. So that's always good for us because the new weaver or spinner, the new enthusiast, is going to be the person that needs equipment. The other thing I've been doing is I've just been calling and talking to a lot of dealers, and economists or people in business say we should be doing and business should be doing is not pulling back, but to keep trying different things, see what works. Try, you know, spinning groups at night or different classes at different times or specials or just things to get people into the shop. So these are the things we're trying to, you know, do ourselves in our business, keep moving forward, keep making new products, specials for our dealers, talking to people, just a lot of outreach.
Yeah, as a teacher, I've been noticing that all my Rigid Heddle classes are filling up. It's just been astounding.
Rigid Heddle right now, I think, is very popular for a few reasons. The knitters are looking at it and finding that it's kind of an easy and inexpensive way to get into weaving. But also, I think that shops that were traditionally for harness weaving are finding that introducing Rigid Heddle in their shops is a way to get people started in weaving.
I want to get back to your 40th anniversary. Congratulations.
Yeah, isn't that great?
What are you doing to celebrate?
We are doing a lot of things. I think the thing I'm most excited about is our contest. We're calling it I Made It on My Shacked Contest. It has terrific prizes. We're going to give away a Cherry Wolf Pup, and then we're doing a limited edition of Cherry Mashless Wheels, and we're going to make a super-duper special one. I don't know.
Wait. You're doing the matchless in Cherry?
Cherry, we are. We just announced it. People are excited because we've never done that before.
Do you have pictures of that on your website?
Not yet.
Mm.
We haven't got the cherry parts yet to actually have one to photograph.
But I interrupted you. So how do people get involved in the I Made It on My Shacked contest?
We are encouraging shops to get involved, having their own contest that then they submit. And then the shop that has the most entries is going to get a party thrown by us for all their entrants. They can go to our website and just print out all the materials right there. They just have to make something. We have spinning categories and weaving categories, and we have expert categories and novice. I mean, the idea is to get people involved in the craft.
What's the difference between a novice and an expert category? Is it something that you determine yourself, whether or not you're an expert?
Well, we say if you've been doing it less than 2 years, you're a novice.
Okay.
Though I have people say, well, I've been doing it for 20 years, but I'm still a novice. But, you know, we've got to draw the line somewhere.
Gotcha. I understand there's also a YouTube component of that.
Oh, yeah. I'm really excited about the YouTube component. So this is like a side thing. People that enter the contest don't have to do a YouTube entry, but they can do a YouTube entry if they want, doing anything, making their project or demonstrating a product or a process using Shacked equipment. And then they just give us the link to that, and then we're going to judge that separately. And the price for that is a $250 shopping spree.
When I saw the YouTube part of the contest, I got very excited because it seemed like a great way to get spinning and weaving how-to information out into a place that's very visible on the internet right now. Was that one of your goals?
Yes, absolutely. Because if you go and search for weaving, you don't see that much on YouTube. Whereas if, for example, you went and searched for knitting, there's tons of stuff. I just think we need to have a lot more visibility on the internet that way.
Well, that sounds just wonderful.
There's going to be a lot of prizes and a lot of different ways to win. People can write their story. We're going to give prizes for their best shacked equipment story. So I think just the more people involved, it's going to be more fun. And then we're going to have a show here. The submissions are due September 1st. And then starting October 1st, we're going to have people, well, submissions will be online. And then if you are a finalist, then you'll ship your piece here, and we'll have a show in our showroom, and then we're going to have a some sort of event on October 8th during Spinning and Weaving Week just to celebrate that. So I think our big 40th anniversary blast is going to be on that day.
What have you got planned for the next 40 years?
Oh, what do we have planned? I got to let Barry answer that question.
The next 40 years. Well, let's end with death. And start with some keeping the enthusiasm up. We're having really a lot of fun at work still. We have excellent staff here. We have our employee gardens. And this year we're going to probably put in a chicken coop and probably raise a pig for the mid-July Friends of Shack's pig roast. We're continuing to plan, you know, all kinds of stuff. It's just outrageously fun.
Thank you so much for your time. It's been wonderful talking to you, and I'm just delighted to hear you're doing so well.
Great. Thanks for your call.
And now a brief word about the new Weave Zine launch. I've completely redone the website. I've rolled together the Weavecast, Weave Zine, and Weave Geek content into one master site. There are some really cool features that I've been able to add with the new technology I'm using. One of them is full text search. So now, for example, if you wanted to go listen to the Weavecast where I interviewed Terry Helwig about the One Thread project, instead of having to remember which episode that happened in or going and searching through old show notes, you can simply type into the search box Terry Helwig or One Thread Project, and that will pop right up for you. There are a lot of other features. Now there is the ability to stream the audio directly from the Weave Zine site. This means that it will be much easier for people to try out Weavecast before they make the big commitment to set up iTunes and create a podcast subscription. You just click a button and it starts playing. The downside of this move is that I am not sure if it's going to be possible for me to keep the same feed URL in iTunes. I'm working with the Apple folks and trying to get them to see things my way, but their tools for submitting podcasts don't really provide an update function. So I'm trying to make that happen, but I'm not sure. In any event, if you go up to the news site, that's www.weavezine.com. You'll see down on the right-hand side at the bottom a way to subscribe to the new audio feed, and that will work regardless of what I manage to work out with Apple. And you can also, if you look in the navigation up on the left, you'll see Listen to Weavecast, and that will get you to a browsable version of the show notes. So apologies if this switch causes some short-term pain, but I think in the long run, this new platform is going to really make things better. And it's going to give me the opportunity to add a lot of new functionality. I'm excited to say that this is the first episode that includes some audio edited by the ensemble. Those folks are just on fire for audio editing. I am really proud of the way everybody has gotten the tools installed and just really rolled up their sleeves and gotten down to work. It's made doing the show a lot more fun to have people to collaborate. So thank you. Y'all are the awesome. The Kay Fassett interview this episode was edited by Christine Riedel. And I have to say, I really needed the help this month because with getting the new Weave Zine site out the door, I just didn't have time to edit audio, so I really appreciate the help. There's a quick little story behind the Kay Fassett interview. I had been negotiating with Kay Fassett's studio assistant, Brandon, to arrange a telephone interview. When Brandon briefly mentioned that Kay would be in Portland for a quilting show, and wasn't it too bad that that was so far away from Seattle? And I said, Portland? I can drive to Portland? I think that surprised him. But you know us Americans and our cars, and I just love a road trip. So one morning I got up at 6 a.m., drove 3 hours to Portland, interviewed Kafe for a half hour, and then immediately turned around and drove back home because I had to pick up my kid from preschool. I had an absolute blast. The hotel Kafe was staying in was tiny, antique, and gorgeous, and the man himself was an absolute delight to talk to. And if you listen to this interview, you'll hear that the audio quality was much, much better than I would have gotten over the phone. Which just goes to show how far I'll go for good sound and how much I love doing this show. I'm here in Portland with Kay Fassett, an internationally known artist who works with color in a variety of mediums.
Mm-hmm.
So welcome.
Thank you very much.
Now, you work in knitting and quilting and textile design as well as painting.
Mm-hmm.
What do you consider your basic medium?
Color. color and pattern is my obsession, and anything that can address that, I'm interested in. So I've actually had a little spell at weaving. I know that you're involved in the weaving world, and I've done a bit of weaving. I didn't like the fact that I had to set up a loom and all that pre-doing of things. I'm a very spontaneous creator, and I love to pick up two needles and cast on and then just start to knit something and see what comes out. So I'll have a vague idea of what I'm doing. But everything that I do, from mosaic, patchwork, painting even, my paintings are very much occupied with pattern on pattern, a patterned object on a patterned cloth, and so and then color arrangements. So it's always my obsession.
One of the characteristics of your work is that you have many, many different colors.
Mm.
Did that emerge early on, or did that evolve?
I think that came fairly early on. The first sweater that I knitted when I first bought a group of yarns in Scotland and was heading back to London, where I was living then, I bought 20 colors and put every single one into my first sweater. And it was never occurred to me to bake white bread. You know, if I was going to do it, it had to be fancy. Because why do it? You know, there were plenty of cheap sweaters you could buy in the Five and Dime and, you know, places like that. I wanted to create something that was worthy of my time and energy.
So on that line, what advice would you give someone who is afraid of color, as so many people are, you know, afraid of mixing a lot of different colors, who are kind of stuck in that monochromatic?
Well, my motto in those days was, when in doubt, add 20 more colors. But because, I mean, very quickly, I started using like 200 colors in a big coat and things. I don't know. Color is such a richness, such a magic ingredient, and it's the one thing that we can do if we're making things by hand that makes it totally uniquely our own. If we knit a beige sweater, what's to distinguish it from any other bloody beige sweater out there? And there's a lot in this world. But as far as the fear of color, there is a definite fear of color. You're absolutely right. I think people are afraid of not looking chic, or, you know, having a sort of mature attitude to design or something, or making some terrible whopper of a mistake when they play with color. And my feeling is, I look at children and primitive cultures, so-called primitive cultures, where they just wallow in color and love it and celebrate it, and there's no fear at all. And I take my cue from them, because everything they produce that's colorful is richly, wonderfully colorful, and it never puts a foot wrong. I mean, you can go to Mexico and Africa and places like that. They'll use outrageous color, like the most shocking opalescent pink and lime green and everything together. But somehow it works. There is a harmony and a humanity to it. I think I'm interested. When I was painting, I remember a painting girl that I respected a lot at that time said to me, the one thing I look for in a painting is life. I want a liveliness to that paint stroke. And I think that I feel that way about textiles. I don't want a chic, minimal textile that will bore me to tears after looking at it for 5 minutes. I want something that is going to intrigue me and keep me looking back. And that's what color does for me, a complexity of color.
Yeah, my eyes keep getting drawn to this sweater that you've got behind you for exactly that.
Mirage. Yes, yes. This is a sweater I knitted when I was traveling across Morocco. And I was well, partly Morocco and partly India, because I was working on two different things that were very similar. But it's those cultures are so full of color. You know, we would come across spice markets and, you know, wonderful markets of cloth with these stripes and amazing colors hanging together. I would just put all of that information into the textile as I was traveling. So that's what Mirage is. It's just those influences.
Now, I'm looking at this sweater and there's, you know, just dozens of colors and it's beautiful. Have you ever put together colors and just looked at it and gone, ugh? You know, have there been whoppers?
Yeah, there definitely have been things that have not been that harmonious, and I've learned a lot from them. I also learn a lot from my students who try to work with color in the same complex way that I do. And very often get a kind of schizophrenic thing going, whether it's pulling apart. We've got two different quilts happening or two different sweaters of a very dark, pungent kind of mysterious coloring, you know, mixed with a sort of pastel Victorian look or something, you know. So, I mean, I've just done a workshop, so I'm very up with this experience that happens when there's two very different worlds colliding. I want harmony. I want absolute beauty. I don't want just colors thrown together. I want those colors to add up to something that makes you go, wow, and draws you in. Color can really repel people if it's not carefully. And when I say carefully, I don't mean intellectually put together. It's a very spontaneous process. I'm putting these together, but I'm removing things that distract or deaden the other colors. There are colors that enhance each other, and there's a real relationship. And, you know, that pink really talks to that red, and that red talks to that maroon, and they start to enliven each other. And a little bit of orange lifts the whole palette, and a little bit of lavender cools it, etc. So all of those things are things that work toward a perception of that color. I'm sounding very intellectual now, and it isn't at all. I've sort of analyzed it through the years, but basically it's just a matter of putting this, putting that, and then suddenly that bit of yellow is very distracting. That pulls away from everything, so I pull that out, etc. Same time, one mustn't be afraid to put in very awkward things too, because sometimes that weird lime green or whatever can suddenly bring the whole thing to life in another kind of way. So you had to be open to that.
So it sounds like your process is largely you put colors together and then build up a tone, it sounds like, because you were talking in terms of somber or light and pastel.
Yes. It's sometimes it's that. And sometimes it's something quite other. I mean, it can be being free to really improvise and find discordant notes that add up to a harmony, but a very alive harmony, you know, that's got it's kind of like improvising with music, you know. It has that, you know, how jazz got, you know, very discordant but fascinating and wonderful syncopated rhythms, and all of that came out of kicking over the old harmonies and starting to play with something a little edgy. And so one must be open to that, particularly when I produce patchwork fabrics. One thing that people always say, I mean, it's hard for me to judge it myself because I'm just kind of bumbling along doing my thing, but I do get the comment all the time that I put the colors together in a way that's very different from any other designer in the market. And I think that what I'm doing is always trying to find that strange little color that kicks the other colors into a kind of excitement, you know, so that it's a very alive fabric that they're taking and adding to their patchwork quilts.
I'm curious, when you put colors together, does the medium affect that? Like if you're putting together patchwork fabrics, is your process or your colors different than when you put together a knit versus needlepoint?
Yes, I mean, slightly. One thing about needlepoint is every stitch creates a shadow, so you go for slightly lighter, clearer colors than you would think, because every color becomes slightly deeper when you stitch it. So the medium does, of course, affect color. Knitting is another thing entirely. That creates this kind of strange mesh texture, which does something else to the color. But patchwork fabrics, I'm creating a palette. I'm creating a paint box for people to then. It's a very strange thing. You know, when I bring in a new artist and I say, now you do these beautiful flowers and things, of course, we're going to chop them up. The first thing we're going to do when we see your fabrics is to cut them into small pieces and then sell them to something else. And so it's like, oh, you know, they're not sure. So you have to think about that you are making raw material to be chopped up and added to other worlds of color. And it's a wonderful, exciting proposition, but you have to think about that color in a different way. You know, sometimes something multicolored can look red overall, but if you put in too many highlights, it suddenly has these big white blotches, which make it very, very different. So you just, you know, you have to think about how it's going to look when it's cut.
Well, getting back to weaving, mm-hmm. I read that you did some work with Oxfam going mm-hmm. to like India and Guatemala.
That's right.
Could you tell us a little bit about that project?
Oh, yeah. That was one of the most wonderful things. We were asked by Oxfam, which is this charity in England, to go to a part of the world where they'd had very bad disasters like tidal waves and things, and it wiped out these little villages because they had dirt floors and little primitive houses, and then they had dug out a hole for their looms. So they would sit down in this hole, and the loom would come to their chest, and they would work. So you can imagine when a tidal wave would roar through their village, it would just leave it sodden and mucky, and they couldn't work for months and months and months. And so they were suffering very badly from these disasters. Also, companies had gone in and ordered a lot of fabric and then left them not buying the fabric and things like that. So they were in a bad way. And I came along and I suddenly thought, if I'm going to design weaving, I want it to be very special. So I thought, what would I like if I found a woven fabric that I wanted to make a shirt out of? That's the way I would start. I'll design a shirt that I would like to have made, because I didn't know how to get started. And I just did these. I remembered back in the early 50s, you know, people used to have these wonderful, colorful shirts from India, as a matter of fact. And they were bars of color, just great stripes of color. And I thought, that's very easy for them to do. I don't have to think about jacquard weaving or anything like that. I'll just do very simple bars of color. And I knitted a great sample of knitting and sent it out. Of course, the cry went up. This is not weaving. I said, I know. Just make some weaving that looks like this knitting. So when I got there, they hadn't done anything. You know, I sent everything ahead so that they could have samples ready for me to look at. I knew we'd be a few days in this village. Well, it was a delightful village and these beautiful little huts and everything else, but they hadn't prepared anything. And we had to drive 4.5 hours to find yarn, because they didn't have any yarn to start with, just to make the sample. And then we found these beautiful cottons and came back, and we started to work with them. And thank goodness there was a weaving expert there who knew about warps and wefts. I just thought you just lay out these stripes and weave them. It never occurred to me that every color you put across them was going to totally change them. So that one warp we were able to make into the most gorgeous peacock blue cast fabrics, you know, with cobalt and rich turquoises and everything in it. And then that same warp would suddenly turn into whole shades of red and then whole wonderful things of lime green and ochre and gold and orange and so forth and so on. So it was just by changing the warp, we were making these fabulous different colorings.
But the warp or the weft?
I mean the weft, yes. Sorry, yes.
As a weaver, I'm terribly curious, what color warp were you using as the background for all these weft colors?
I just laid out my stripes. So the stripes were in the warp, and then we were just weaving different colors across.
Oh, okay.
You see, to change the starting point, it was just like a nice orange, a nice red, a nice peacock blue, a nice cold blue, all these different colors. But then, of course, as you put yellow across that, it would utterly change, and then red, and then black, and all these different things. So it was, I mean, probably one of the most thrilling color experiences I've ever had in my life, to see these changes and all these things come out. So we made one big sampler blanket of all these different colorings, and then watching them, you know, put this down the street of the village in a long piece and put rice paste on it and do all the things that they had to do to preserve the cloth and stretch it and everything. And then, of course, we put it in an order for all of the stripes. I wanted a bolt of each color so that we could then start playing with them and see what we could make. And they couldn't do it. For a year, they didn't come up with an order. And we couldn't imagine what was happening. And finally, I sent Oxfam back into the village. I said, I've ordered this. What's happened? Well, they had no money to buy the raw material to make the things. But they just never said it. They just thought we were just dreamers. So we gave them enough money to get going, and off we went. And that first collection stayed in my range for about 10 years, and some of it is still in the range all these years later, and became probably our trademark. I mean, people were more interested in those fabrics than anything else I've done. Meanwhile, I've done lots and lots of collections of flower prints and everything else to go with them, but those stripes were the basis of a lot of our early patchworks.
I'm working on a project recently where I have a knitter who was knitting with two colors of yarn, and I was weaving with them. And I found that the way the knitting interacts, you know, the yarn interacts on itself, and the way the weaving, it kind of interacts, you know, thread by thread. I ended up having to use different colors to get the same result.
Yes.
Just because of the way they blended, it was very interesting. I needed a bigger value change for the weaving.
Yes.
Yeah. The fiber arts are largely dominated by women. And yet you are, you know, an outstanding, talented male working in that field. And I see that you have done a Men Who Knit DVD.
Yes, yes, I have. Yeah.
And one of the things that DVD claimed to answer was why more men should knit. So I'm curious.
Yeah. Well, it's called Real Men Knit.
Real Men Knit.
And when I went to Norway, one of the journalists there said, yes, and what do the other ones do? Which I thought was wonderful. But, you know, knitting is just one of those wonderful things. I mean, I suppose in the old hippie times where I sort of flowered, there were lots of guys knitting and crocheting and embroidering and doing beadwork and all those things. You know, we were all interested in color, and we were looking at the cultures of India and China and so forth, and the American Indians and everything else with a completely new light. I mean, we were devouring, you know, those beaded moccasins and the Navajo blankets and the wonderful weaves and block prints coming in from India and making our clothes out of those things and so forth. And so as artists, I think a lot of us just got fascinated by the practical world of made objects rather than so much in painting. So to me, it was a switch of media. It didn't have anything to do. I didn't care, you know, whether I was a man knitting or not. To me, that was just another kind of paint I was using, you know, a manipulating color.
Our last bit of audio today is what I'm calling Farm Fresh audio. Today was the day that my sheep get sheared. So I took a microphone on location out back to my barn and interviewed the gentleman who stops by every year to shear my three ewes. He lives in Wales, but comes out to visit his family every year and makes the round while he's out here. And it's a really good thing because there aren't many shearers left, especially who will come out and shear three sheep. Because I just have a small spinner's flock, so it's hard to talk them into coming out. And I think it's just hysterical that my sheep, who are Shetlands, a breed that is imported from the UK, now have a shearer who is also imported from the UK. It just seems fitting somehow.
My name's Ivian Morgan.
Cool. And you're from?
Wales in the United Kingdom.
Cool. And so you've just come out and sheared my sheep for me today. Thank you very much.
So you're welcome.
So how long have you been shearing?
Oh, that would be telling my age, but in excess of 30 years.
And how did you get into that?
Well, we had sheep back home in Wales on the Brecon Beacons, and we had a flock of 450 sheep, so it was a case of learning from a very young age. But now it's a dying art, as no one wants to do it. So I just try and keep going, and as long as I can, as long as my body holds out, I'll keep shearing.
So what advice would you give to someone who was interested in learning?
Oh, it's a very good way to see the world. Go to shearing school. It's an awful lot to take in. I would say it's a 5-year apprenticeship to be semi-professional. A lot of people would go to New Zealand, or the thing to do is learn the basics and then just get stuck into a lot of sheep.
I gotcha. Just in closing, your best shearing tip?
My best shearing tip, the customer's always right.
Well, thank you very much, both for the interview and for the help with the girls.
Oh, no problem at all. You're welcome.
That's all for this episode. And now it's time to get warped, because everyone knows you have to be warped to weave. I'm going to play you out with a song called The Ballad of Fenton. This is another song by Tom Smith. I'm playing this for my fearless shearer, and I'm sure that he's run into a few sheep like this before.
Once in a land far away, on a beautiful day, on a wide grassy knoll. There was a cute little sheep who was drifting to sleep when the earth opened up and swallowed him sheep from hell. It's right out of a storybook, but the signs are there if you know to look. A nasty mustache on his face, sheep of tears, but this one's a beast. It's an almost complete disguise, except for the fangs and the glowing eyes. If the lion hunts down with the spam, he'll be found in three pieces of varying size. From hell. He's a strategist and a conspirer with a few dozen enemies list. And the Weekly World News Enquirer are afraid to admit he exists. He's a dangerous mind without equals. And if you're convinced that I'm wrong, take a look at the various sequels. Josh Smith's gonna write you this song. How he came to be. Now that's done, but what can you do to stop the sheer terror of Fenton 2? The story would not be complete without Fenton 3. The last time bleach, Baron McKibble comes back for more with a seventh sequel. SC4. In the next one, we get to meet Olga, the one girl sees to whom he is true, and their lovemaking gets pretty vulgar, and SC5UW. But the forces of goodness are scheming to slay him and bring the world peace, and you'll spend nearly 2 hours screaming that Death Sheep seeks rest in peace. And in the clover. What is this bull worth? But don't think that heaven is finally winning. Watch for Death Sheep 7, high nilparking. Starving Phantom, he's a cuddly disaster. Demonic sweater. What could be better than fifteen of Death Sheep from hell?
That was The Ballad of Fenton by Tom Smith. When I played this for Eric, he looked at me and he said, Where do you find this stuff? Well, the answer is the PodSafe Music Network. I'd like to thank the audio producer for this episode, Christine Riedel. Thank you for helping make this episode happen. Weavecast is brought to you through the generosity of our donating listeners. This episode, I'd like to thank Gina, Linda, Joe, Carol, and Sherry. Thank you for helping support the show. Our sponsor this episode is Cotton Clouds. For 30 years, they've brought you the finest cotton and other cellulose fibers such as rayon chenille, linen, and now bamboo. You can check out their goods online at www.cottonclouds.com.
How many unsung artists in this world? I mean, the great quilts that we look at in the past, there's no name attached. You know, some woman out in the prairie sat down with this edgy, wild idea and put these fabrics together in such a way that, you know, these things are just classically, stunningly beautiful.